Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Motivated by love, Utahns find strength in numbers during protests of Trump's monument slashing. After a Utah man was killed by lightning, should other hikers be worried? And here's where fireworks have caused the most problems in Utah. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Right now, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Addie Barrett. Addie, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So let's talk about this story. Of course, last week on this program, we talked about President Trump's actions, greatly reducing both Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante monuments. So now we get at least some Utahns expressing their disapproval of that, I guess. So protests, I guess, happened around the state?
Yeah, that's right. There was a whole series of protests that were coordinated on Monday evening here in Utah. There were protests at the offices of our Republican congressional delegates and at the governor's mansion. And there were more than 1,000 people by our count as reporters that were at these protests who came out for that series of protests on Monday.
So you had help from Brooke Larson, Dylan Eubank, and Andrew Christiansen. So where were you? You were in Salt Lake, I guess?
I was in Salt Lake City at the governor's mansion.
Yeah. So what was the mood there? What were people saying?
The mood was honestly kind of like jubilant and optimistic. There were probably 300 to 400 people there over the course of the hour. And people were really so thrilled, I think, to be in community with people who shared their concerns. There was definitely a threat of anger toward Governor Cox outside his house. There was definitely some anger for the congressional delegates. But it was really seemed like people were feeling pretty joyful, honestly. And as cars drove past, they were honking. And there was definitely in the people that I talked to a feeling of optimism about being in a group that large and protesting this downsizing of the monuments.
Now, you note in your story, most Utahns oppose shrinking the monuments, according to various polls. I guess there was some sentiment in some of these areas, and again, it happened, Washington County, Moab, Provo, right, and Salt Lake were some of the areas these protests were happening. Some folks at the protests were saying that that our delegation, our leaders, are not representing what Utahns want.
Yeah, there's absolutely a lot of people that I talk to who are really frustrated with the congressional representatives and with our senators as well. Even though Donald Trump was the one who signed the order that downsized the monuments, Governor Cox was there. The members of our federal delegation were there, and they were behind Trump, and they were smiling, and they were cheering on the order. And so even though it wasn't, you know, Cox who signed the order, the people I spoke to feel that he has some responsibility and that he should have, represented them as well, not only the people in the state who are happy to see it downsized. So yeah, absolutely. There's responsibility, the people that I talked to argued, on Utah representatives and our leaders here.
There's one sign, there's a photo in the story, protect our public lands. That's the big one that I can tell from the photo, at least the size I have it. What were some of the other signs? Were people chanting anything?
Lots of the classic protest chants, you know, this is what democracy looks like. There were some hyper-specific chants as well. Representative Celeste Malloy sponsored a bill in Congress last year that ultimately did not pass, but she sought, along with Mike Lee, to sell off millions of acres of public land. And so there was a specific chant about Malloy. They chanted, Malloy, this land is not yours to destroy. Kind of a mouthful, but hyper-specific. And then, you know, with Governor Cox, there were, how can I say it? How did I say it in the story? There were a number of signs with puns related to Cox's last name, and outside of his house, that was pretty popular.
And the governor was not there, we understand.
Yes, that's right. The governor, according to his public schedule, which is shared with reporters every week, was actually at a like a concert and ceremony for the Days of 47 with Pioneer Day tomorrow. So he was not home with the protesters outside of his house.
What about some of these other areas? I guess it's a similar signs, similar protests, it looks like.
Yeah, according to my colleagues, the vibe at the protests across the state were pretty similar. It seems like the group in Salt Lake City was probably the largest, but my colleague in St. George, my colleague in Moab said there were dozens of people, somewhere between 100 and 150 at those protests. And very similar conversations were happening at those protests with the people who were present about their concerns about the land being sold off and the way that our delegation handled the response to it. It seems like there was a pretty unified response and conversation at all five of these protests.
About 25 people gathered at the Bears Ears National Monument sign west of Bluff.
Yeah, there was a protester there at the monument. And that land in specific that land specifically at Bears Ears has been the subject of so much conversation and so much debate. I was talking to an indigenous woman who was up here in Salt Lake, who's a member of the Hopi Tewa tribe, and she was talking about how at Bears Ears, five different tribal nations have called that land home and shared that land. And for your listeners who are aware of some of the history of the indigenous tribal nations here in Utah, they are not monolithic and they do not always get along. The Shoshone and the Utes were enemies, and there was there's been a lot of centuries, thousands of years of interaction and wars, and these tribes are not monolithic again. And so she noted that the fact that five different tribal nations have called Bears Ears home is really remarkable. Just the number of tribes who have a really sacred relationship to that land is really notable. And so yes, there were people who gathered at the monument itself to protest as well, and that makes a lot of sense.
You and your colleagues quote several Native Americans, indigenous peoples, in your story. What else were they saying?
There were absolutely a lot of indigenous people who were talking about just the sacredness of the land itself. The indigenous approach to the land not being separate from us was a conversation that I had with several people. And the importance of indigenous leadership on this issue was also a conversation that me and my colleagues were having, given that this land is historically sacred to the tribes. And the tribes are also party to a lawsuit that is challenging the downsizing of the monuments, and keeping them as people native to this land at the heart of the conversation. I think it's really valuable and important for us as reporters, and also, for people who are activists on either side of the issue.
What was the, you talked about the vibe, a pretty positive vibe, I guess. There's the governor's mansion. What about these other protests?
The sense that I got from my colleagues as well. I can't speak to it exactly because, of course, I wasn't there. I was up here in Salt Lake City. But my sense from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, which was SUWA, the group that organized these protests, that it was as much about their executive director said to me, "We do this from a place of love, not from a place of grievance." And I think that that kind of speaks to the energy that many of us felt at these protests, that although there was absolutely anger and absolutely frustration, that the heart of the conversation is really about the love that people have for this land here in Utah and how special it is. And everyone I talked about going down there as a kid with their families and being in Southern Utah and what wonderful memories they have and wanting to keep that for their own children and the next generation. And that was a lot of the conversation that I think many of us had with the people that we spoke to around the state.
Anything else you'd like to say about the story?
It's just interesting because this is part of a much larger back and forth. It was Bill Clinton who originally designated Grand Staircase as a monument, or I believe that's correct. But really, the debate has come with the Trump administration. There's been a back and forth as Trump downsized to these monuments during his first term. Biden undid that downsizing during his term, and then Trump re-downsized them now that he's back in office. And a lot of people I talked to were just frustrated with this ping-ponging back and forth with the administrations. And even people who are in support of the downsizing have raised that concern. And I think it's just going to be, I think that's a really big question as we move forward, you know, where we go from here and ultimately settle on a lasting solution that isn't just ping-ponging back and forth as we get Democratic and Republican administrations is a really big question with these monuments.
Well, we've been talking with State Watch reporter Addie Baird telling us about this story. Addie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to head toward a break here. When we come back, here's the headline we'll be talking about. After a Utah man was killed by lightning, should other hikers be worried? We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we bring in for this segment Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Andy, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about a couple of these headlines in this segment. Here's one. A Utah man was killed by lightning. Should other hikers be worried? And here's where fireworks have caused the most problems in Utah. Let's start with the lightning one. This is somewhat rare for people to die from lightning strike, but it did happen recently.
Yeah, it happened on Sunday. A 59-year-old man was struck by lightning while hiking near Snowbird Resort. And it's only the second lightning strike death that's happened in Utah since in this decade, in the 2020s, since 2016, actually. So this is a pretty rare occurrence. There have been 23 lightning deaths since 1996 in our state, so over the last 30 years. And but nevertheless, it does happen occasionally. And so my story tried to look at when and where this tends to happen.
So, yeah, tell us again, how frequently do these events occur in Utah?
Yeah, I mean, really less than one per year on average. Like I said, 23 over the last three decades. In general, Utah does have more lightning strikes than kind of the rest of the country. You know, despite Utah's population being about 1% of America's total population, right? About 3.5 million people live here compared to about 330, 340 million nationwide. We were responsible for about 2.23% of our country's lightning strike deaths over those last 30 years.
So a bit higher than the national average, although overall numbers would be lower. Why do we think Utah's higher?
Generally, I think the reason is we have a lot of Utahns doing leisure activities outside, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons we rank so well in kind of health statistics, for example. And, you know, kind of makes sense based on what a lot of Utahns are doing. You know, there are a lot of common activities, and I'm sure you'll ask about it, just kind of what are the ones that people are doing while they get struck by lightning. And it's kind of some of the same things that Utahns do frequently, especially during the summer when thunderstorms are most common.
So tell me about the data set. There's a government agency that keeps track of, I guess, lightning strikes around the nation?
Yeah, it's the NOAA, so the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's their National Centers for Environmental Information. And they, because these lightning strikes are relatively uncommon, you know, they're roughly 27 per year in America, you can actually just kind of compile what happened for all of them. And so in my story on the Salt Lake Tribune website, we actually have a little kind of infographic that shows exactly what happened in each of these kind of instances. You know, from the first one in the database since 1996 is a man who was struck while hiking the Delicate Arch Trail down in Arches National Park near Moab, you know, and all the way to what happened last Sunday when the 59-year-old man was struck. So Some of these were when a person was hiking. Some of them were in parks. Some of them were during camping. But yeah, there's a federal database about this, about these lightning strikes.
I guess before we get into overall, I wanted to maybe look at some of these specifics. You know, there's not that many, thankfully. So you have the entire list here in a graphic in the story. So Uinta Mountains, yeah, I can kind of see that, right? Some high places, but there's one at Mid Valley Elementary School.
Yeah, and you know, that was kind of a tragic incident. There's one that happened in a park in Lehigh in 2015. Thunderstorm just moves across the valley, and lightning struck a tree and critically injured a 50-year-old woman who was kind of underneath that tree.
So yeah, tell me what are some of the activities people are doing when they're struck?
Yeah, it can depend, you know. So in the U.S. nationally, the most common activity that was happening while someone was struck by lightning, struck and killed by lightning, I should specify. Fishing is most common, led to 48 deaths over the last 20 years. Beach activities, whether that's just kind of lounging on the beach or doing other kind of beach activities, that's kind of in second place. That's 32 deaths over the last two decades. Boating, farming and ranching, camping come up next in the top five. There's a myth that golf is the most frequent activity that happens when people are struck by lightning, and that's actually all the way down in 11th place in terms of what people are doing when they're struck by lightning. Here in Utah, hiking and camping are the leading activities people are doing, with kind of five each of the 23 deaths, while just being in a park and social gathering is relatively common here. And then there are a couple of other tragic examples. There's a jet ski incident where someone was struck by lightning while riding a jet ski. A fishing incident as well was our most recent one in 2024.
Now, you made allusion to this. I was very surprised with this. I'll just read this. Of course, what we're talking about is lightning fatalities, and about 90% of those who were struck end up surviving, albeit many with long-lasting injuries. I was surprised by that. 90% survived.
Me too. Yeah, and you know, it's kind of a remarkable statistic, and not sure necessarily. I wasn't able to find any data on kind of what happens to those who struck by lightning and are survive. You know, what kind of injuries they do face, other than the note that sometimes those are lifelong injuries, but. Yeah, it's kind of remarkable that over 90% of people who are struck by lightning do end up surviving through the incident.
Do we have any data at all, or is there any data pattern of time of day or time of year?
We know that most of these happen during the summer months, which makes sense given kind of when thunderstorms happen. July is the most frequent. Happen most frequently on Saturdays because, again, people tend to be outdoors, although that's kind of flatter. Obviously, lightning strikes happen on every day of the week. It's just you do see more than average on Saturdays. And then time-wise, you're looking in afternoon and evening, especially when thunderstorms do tend to roll around.
So another important factor, you note, many lightning strike deaths occur when people are already moving towards safety. I guess they didn't move fast enough. Is that, I guess you should make that decision early, I guess. Is that the lesson?
Yeah, that's one of the things that kind of this database revealed is, you know, if you look at all the hundreds of lightning strike deaths that have happened over the last 20 to 30 years, and especially those in Utah, you see that people are moving towards safety when they were struck pretty frequently. So in 10 of the 23 deaths I looked at here in Utah, people were moving to safety or had tried to take shelter from the storm in some way when they were struck. And in about 150 of the national incidents as well. So that's one of the big lessons from kind of this data collecting effort is kind of early action is better. And, you know, if you are worried about lightning, you should really be considering how to get to safety in time to get to safety, right? So that's definitely one of the big lessons here.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
No, not especially. You know, I don't want to overrate the likelihood that people are dying from lightning strikes, right? Like, this is among dangers that are out there. Like, driving your car is pretty dangerous too, right? There have only been two deaths over the last decade, but I do think, like, when there is danger here, and there are kind of some common sense things people can do to avoid it.
All right. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Let's move to the next story here. Here's the headline. Here's where fireworks have caused the most problems in Utah. And this came out of a look at Utah wildfire data earlier in the month. And of course, this time of year, July, good time to look at where fires are started from fireworks.
Yeah. And, you know, this came from a previous story I did where looking at how Utah wildfires were started, and out of, you know, kind of over 1,000 fires in my sample, only 53 were started from fireworks, and kind of had a lot of readers in my inbox asking about why, there was such a focus on fireworks bans and fireworks started fires when that wasn't the leading cause of fires or really even close. And it turns out that really it's kind of a matter of what fires you care about, right? Where, you know, yes, not a lot of wildfires are started by fireworks, but a lot of kind of city fireworks fires are started by fireworks. So things that are, you know, are happening more in urban and suburban areas, and there do tend to be a lot of fires. So between 2019 and 2025, there were 1,358 fireworks-related fires in the National Fire Incident Reporting System database, which is pretty remarkable, right? That we have over 1,000 fireworks-started fires here in Utah over that kind of six-year sample.
And these happening, what I could guess, July might be the biggest month. I don't know.
Yeah, July by a lot. In fact, I've got a graph of my story kind of showing fires started by fireworks per day. And yeah, July, as you can imagine, the area between July 3rd and July 5th is by far the most common time period for fires started by fireworks. And then it's this upcoming weekend, the 23rd through the 25th kind of area, where you see the second peak. And then really, outside of July, they're actually pretty rare. 70% of total fireworks fires start between those two weekends.
I guess in Utah, we have not one, but two holidays involving fireworks in July. So
yeah, correct.
It's a factor, yeah. Categories of fires that were started by fireworks. Give me an idea. What are the top ones?
Yeah, so most of them turn out to be grass fires or brush fires, and they even categorize them as brush and grass fires. But so of those 1,300 or so that I mentioned earlier, about 800 of those are grass fires or brush and grass fires. And you know, whether or not they keep track of the acreage or the square footage that is burned in those fires, some of them can be really relatively small. Some of them could be larger areas. And then you get down to there are a lot of dumpster or trash fires started, 115 of those. There are 52 building fires started by those fireworks. Again, this is a six-year sample size from 2019 to 2025. And then you start to get in, there are 20 passenger vehicle fires, so kind of normal standard car fires as a result of fireworks. There are fires in parking lots. There were 22 forest or wildland fires started as well. So it is kind of a larger variety, but they tend not to be very frequently kind of structure fires, only occasionally.
Mm-hmm. And you have a graphic here. Where do fires started by fireworks occur? I guess it's top one's open land or field. The second one, I was a bit surprised at family dwellings.
Yeah, same. And, you know, so some of these fires starting in like the grass of people's front or backyards. But yeah, and one or two family dwellings is one of the categories in this NFIRS database. 308 fires started kind of at or around someone's home as a result of fireworks. And then kind of the third most common is a vehicle parking area, a parking lot, where 112 fires were started as well.
Because this is an indication where people are setting off fireworks, essentially.
Yeah, agreed. And kind of you may, you know, your grass front yard or backyard or whatever may be more flammable than you might think.
This was a little distressing. Several 20 some odd fires were started at a church or mosque or synagogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not sure if that's like a church parking lot, like a ward house parking lot, or if it's on the grass in those areas as well. But you know, again, people are kind of, it seems like they're tending to find kind of open spaces or nearby spaces for them to do these fireworks, and then a lot of accidents naturally occur.
Now, the data set shows where firework-related fires are in the state of Utah. Where are the most?
Yeah, you know, a lot of, we've got every zip code kind of represented here on our map, and the most happen down in the southern Utah area. The zip code with the highest number of fireworks-related fires is in Cedar City. The second highest is in St. George. So, and meanwhile, so there have been 81 in Cedar City, 69 in St. George, and actually only just 38 in Salt Lake City. And maybe that's just because of, maybe that's heat, maybe that's the you know, just the urban, how urban the landscape is. I'm not sure, but despite it being much more populated, Salt Lake City has had fewer fireworks fires than those two southern cities.
So you recall for us in the story that fire officials supported a statewide fireworks ban on the 4th of July. What's happening over this Pioneer Day weekend? What's the rule?
Yeah, now it's been kind of more up to a city-by-city approach, and mayors and city governments have had the chance to decide what their policies for this weekend will look like. Fireworks are banned here in Salt Lake City, for example. Other cities have done different things. You know, there was an interesting story by our Robert Kirky this week about how a mayor from a Salt Lake City town was actually received death threats and a kind of a threat to burn their house down if they didn't institute a fireworks ban. So it's a really, you know, politically contentious topic. And, you know, the recent rains, especially this week, have given a little bit more leeway, I think, for fireworks to happen this holiday for Pioneer Day than they were on the 4th of July. But that doesn't mean that the risk is completely eliminated either.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to head toward a break here. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. He'll stay with us into the next segment. And here's a couple of headlines we're going to talk about in that next and last segment. Salt Lake City set a record high of 109 degrees. Then came the conspiracy theories. Also, a wall of dust from the Great Salt Lake swept across the valley in early July. What was in that air? We'll talk about those stories on Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune, following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we have with us Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson, who's staying with us for the next segment, this segment as well. So let's start with this headline. This was from last week, but a fascinating story. Here's the headline. Salt Lake City set a record high of 109 degrees. Then came the conspiracy theories. First of all, tell me about that record high, and where was this recorded?
Yeah, so, you know, the record high was 109 degrees, and it was recorded at the Salt Lake City International Airport Station, which has kind of been the Salt Lake City default reporting station, the one that gets the attention for a long time now, for, I believe, at least 8 decades. You know, the station first opened there in 1928, didn't become the default Salt Lake City station until 1940. But yeah, you know, we have a long history of kind of daily and even every minute kind of readings from that station. And So when it reached a record of 109 degrees a couple of weeks ago, it became a talking point for a lot of people online. And in particular, there was kind of this conspiracy theory kind of claim that, hey, this wasn't necessarily because of actual warmer weather coming to Utah, but was instead because this station was reading differently than it used to. And I wanted to investigate those claims.
Yeah, I was surprised by, but I guess I shouldn't be. Conspiracy theories on everything, and the climate has become politicized, right? So, so you go by claim by claim, taking each of these theories. Claim one: moving that station has changed its readings. So, what did you find?
Yeah, look, and there's, you know, some these claims have some truth to them. You know, this weather station at the airport has been moved multiple times. I mean, in 1933, I'll just read 1943, 1954, 1960, 1978, 1994, and again, most recently in 2010. And so you're kind of moving it around the airport grounds. That most recent move was as they installed a new de-icing pad at the airport. And, you know, the last time it moved by 0.6 miles, you know, a significant distance, which would, you know, affect kind of what the circumstances around the station would be. Heck, moving it even just south on the airport grounds means that you might expect the weather to be a little bit warmer than it would be in a more northerly spot on the airport grounds. So, you know, that is certainly a factor, but generally those moves just kind of within those grounds probably don't make that much of a difference. And in fact, by one model I looked at, that would put kind of that half mile move south most recently is likely to push the thermometer only about 1/100th of a degree hotter compared to where it was before.
So claim number two, the station's immediate surroundings have changed. That's true. I think it went from on dirt to on gravel.
And we have satellite photos that show kind of how the station's surroundings and where the station actually sits has changed. And you know, there are pretty rigid standards about how the thermometer, the sensor, is placed. It's got to be, 5 feet above the ground, for example. It's got to be protected from the sun. It's got to be taken in shadow and kind of prevented from radiation as well. But you know, it's clear that it was kind of more on more desert dirt, if you will, before, and now is on some gravel. And people have wondered if that has changed. So changed the reading. So in 2022, the researcher did a test of this, and they took temperature readings from a part of the airport grounds that sat on kind of some natural grasses, and found that the temperature reading was higher in the graveled area than the grasses, but not by a ton, only by about 0.3 degrees. Again, there is clearly some difference in how you would expect a temperature sensor to react given the environment, but it doesn't seem to be enough to fully explain the high rating, the record high, because that was at 109 degrees Fahrenheit. The previous record was 107 degrees.
So claim three, the station's readings now have a bias toward higher temperatures. I found this one especially interesting. I guess they're somewhat surprised me. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. This is the official station, right? And there's a lot of data that you can check against to see whether this particular station is trending a little hotter or a little cooler than an average.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, obviously Salt Lake City, the station at the International Airport is not the only station in Salt Lake City or in the Valley or kind of nearby. And there are actually, I believe it's over 200 different stations you can kind of pull the readings from. I was pretty particular in wanting to compare the readings at Salt Lake City International Airport to stations that we had a long time history with that were relatively close to the airport, that were with relatively similar conditions, and ended up with seven kind of nearby stations that had daily readings for the last 30 years with kind of within 50 miles of Salt Lake City and at low altitudes like the airport is, right? Or, you know, low relative to Utah or Salt Lake City. And so I compared the readings at the station to those nearby. And for sure, there is some variance. And it's kind of interesting to see how that changes. You know, there were times when the readings at the airport were significantly colder than the nearby pier stations by about 1.5 degrees. And there were times when they were significantly warmer by, again, about 1.5 degrees. Right now, it appears that the most recent readings over the last, you know, we'll call it 6 months or so, have been a little bit cooler than those nearby. So I wasn't seeing any data that showed that, hey, you know, the readings at Salt Lake City International Airport are higher than those nearby.
So the fourth and last claim that you treat in this story, the record, that 109-degree record, was not legitimate. What are skeptics saying here?
Yeah, and you know, kind of there is a couple points here where actually most of the stations in Utah did not set a record on July 12th, the day we're talking about. And, you know, kind of said, hey, okay, this isn't legitimate as a result. And that's certainly true. What's kind of interesting is when I talked to the National Weather Service about this, they kind of pointed out the national picture to me and showed that really we were at the kind of southern tip of a heat front that really affected Wyoming, Montana, even North and South Dakota, and even Canada. So, yes, the kind of stations up at the northern tip of Utah, kind of really just stretching only down to the airport, set records, but most of the southerly stations did not. And that was kind of an interesting finding and kind of explains maybe for a lot of Utahns, it necessarily didn't feel like the hottest day they had ever felt because, well, it probably wasn't in some of our population areas. So, but we also know that, you know, we send weather balloons up into the sky as well and at kind of high barometric ranges and they take these readings from approximately the top of the Wasatch Range in the air, that it was still a new record by 0.5 degree on this date of July 12th. So we have a lot of, again, good evidence here that it wasn't just the readings at Salt Lake City International Airport that were record setting, but there's some a lot of nearby evidence that says that, yes, this day was really hot and there probably isn't a conspiracy to push temperatures hotter at the airport.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, very interesting story. Thanks for telling us about this. Let's do one final story here. We're talking with Andy Larson, Salt Lake Tribune data columnist. This one you did with Sam Moylan. And here's the headline. A wall of dust from the Great Salt Lake swept across the valley in early July. What was in the air? And this is worrisome, right? This air, we think, swept up dirt from the exposed lake bed of Great Salt Lake.
Yeah, and this is obviously a big talking point for kind of Utah and a lot of Utah residents and Utah's future, right? Is if the lake does continue to decline in levels, and if something isn't done to replenish it, how harmful is this lake bed dust? And, you know, how often do these dust storms happen? How harmful, you know, are the chemicals that result? And, you know, obviously one of those 13 chemicals that kind of scientists are worried about is arsenic, which is found in this exposed lake bed. And one of the big things we learned in doing this story, and I have to give Samantha Moylan a lot of credit here. She really took lead on this, but one of the things we learned is that we don't have a lot of great data on air quality around the Great Salt Lake at this point. That we have kind of more limited sensing infrastructure than a lot of these dried up lake beds do. And so we don't usually understand where dust is coming from. The good news is we have a program on the way to kind of fix that. With a lot of these new sensors opening up in 2026, that will kind of change our ability to and really improve our ability to look at this. We do have a station, again, near the airport that gives us some data, and that's the data that I used in this story, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
So how many of these storms happen per year, do you think?
We talked to Great Salt Lake scientist Kevin Perry about this. He estimates, you know, it kind of breaks them into two categories. There's dust storms and then dust events. And those are kind of smaller, shorter lived events that still kick up dust and may send it to the valley. It's estimated that there are about 3 to 8 dust storms per year. And that's, you know, we talked about the one that happened on July 8th. And that was definitely a dust storm. But then there are between 30 to 60 dust events a year, which may send plumes of dust into nearby communities and residences, even if they're not a major storm. And so you kind of see the readings of particles in the air spike on those days as well.
And reading some of these graphics, a lot of days where PM 10, particulate matter 10 levels are definitely exceeding EPA thresholds.
Yeah, these are kind of particles that are at least 10 millimeters in size. And that's kind of the one of the metrics that scientists kind of point to is like, hey, these are the chemical, these are the dust particles that you should really be kind of concerned about breathing in and breathing out on a regular basis. And yeah, you can see, you know, it does just spike pretty often. You know, the EPA's level is about 150. What's the unit here? I think it's micrometers.
See, micrograms per cubic meter, I believe.
Thank you. Micrograms per cubic meter. Thank you. The units are important, but they're hard to keep track of. and so what you see is that happens in my data set of between 2022 and 2026. There were 256 hourly readings above that level, and then 106 distinct days in those 4 years of, or I guess 5 years of levels above that 155 threshold where it's unhealthy for sensitive groups. And then you kind of get into the unhealthy, very unhealthy, and hazardous ranges and see, you know, continued, you know, days where this is happening. So hazardous, for example, is above 425. There were 26 distinct days with that level. And again, that's pretty worrying. The most recent dust storm on July 8th, the airport monitor peaked at 665 micrograms per cubic meter.
Mm. And these particulate matter, is very, very small. It go deep into your lungs and kind of lodge there, causing long-term damage, right?
Yeah, and you know, we still need to kind of understand more as well, like kind of the chemical picture here, right? Like we know that there are these kind of 13 chemicals that are part of the dust in the lake bed. We need to understand more of like what the proportions are, what the proportions of those are that are getting thrown up into the air, and how they affect kind of long-term health. Those studies are underway, and certainly are additional monitoring of the lake bed and dust around the lake bed is going to be really helpful.
And PM10 is just one of the worrisome, you know, chemicals and particles, arsenic, many, many others concentrate on the bed of the Great Salt Lake blown up by this dust. Tell me just a little bit more about this network of new dust monitors. It's going to stretch from northern Utah, what, out to the western Utah?
Yeah, it's an interesting setup. And again, I have to give credit to one of my Tribune colleagues at the paper, Leah Larson, no relation, but she does great work about this plan. And, you know, this has been under works for a few years now, but the really you compare how the Great Salt Lake monitoring system works compared to the kind of similar lakes with dust beds. And we just don't know a lot of information. There's the plan is to install a series of new air monitors from Logan to Delta around the Great Salt Lake on both the west and east sides, and really, again, kind of understand what is actually being blown up into the air on a regular basis. So, you know, we wanted to be tracking hourly. There has been some real talk about how often and this will report and whether this will be kind of real-time data or just kind of looked at in the past. It's an interesting conversation, and obviously a lot of it comes back to what the funding provides for, but This is, you know, again, this is so important to Utah residents and those and people kind of thinking about moving here as well. The future of our state really could kind of depend on how this dust story turns out and whether or not we can prevent this in any kind of significant way.
I think we have time for just a couple minutes on this story. This is an interesting story. I hadn't planned on doing this, but how Utah's drinking habits have changed over the years. You looked at Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services sales records since 2019. What stood out to you? What surprised you?
Yeah, you know, so I got the chance to look at just what the top-selling liquors and beers in Utah were. And there were some kind of surprising stories and stories that kind of fit within some nationwide trends. I'll start on the liquor side, and in those nationwide trends, you know, Tito's Handmade Vodka is by far the highest selling nationwide spirit. It's also by far the highest Utah selling spirit, and it's over doubling the next highest sold in Utah liquor stores, which is right now Jack Daniel's Black Label Whiskey. So it's just kind of an interesting story there where Utah's preferences are matching what's going on nationwide. With Beard, it's a story of kind of we are starting to prioritize more local beers. And in fact, for a while there, and especially during the pandemic, the most popular beer sold in terms of sales volume, in terms of dollars sold, was Natty Daddy, which is the natural light version, kind of 8% version of their beer that is sold for, you know, 99 cents is just kind of the low dollar, a lot of alcohol for cheap option, right? But most recently and over the last few quarters, it's been the Templin family's brewing Furta Double IPA that's been by far the most popular. And you're seeing kind of more local breweries pop up in the top 10 of what's actually sold at Utah liquor stores, which is, I think, kind of cool to see.
You have a pie chart here, top-selling liquors in Utah liquor stores. What are the top, liquors by type?
Despite Tito's being the number one selling brand or number one selling product, whiskey is still the number one sold type of liquor with 32% of the share of liquor sold. Vodka does come in at 23%. And then tequila and mezcal are put in that same the same category. That's 16% of sales. Rum is about 6% of sales and then goes down from there.
Well, we've been talking with Andy Larson, who is Salt Lake Tribune data columnist. Andy, thanks so much for taking a lot of time here on the program with us.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks again, Tom.
You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And our thanks to State Watch reporter Addie Baird, who joined us early in the program. Definitely data columnist Andy Larson, who did a couple of segments on this program for us today. Appreciate that. And thanks to you for listening. Hope you'll be with me again next time.